Good afternoon. Thanks for sticking out till the bitter end. And it's a great turnout for the end of the conference. For those of you who came to hear Gary Harper, I'm sorry, I'm not him. My name's Doug Bruce. We'd like to thank Gary as well as our colleague Steve Rogers and our colleagues within the Adolescent Trials Network who were instrumental in recruiting the youth who participated in the studies I'm going to be talking about today. So we have no relationships to disclose financially. I will say that the data that's presented today came from two studies that were funded through the ATN, ATN-020 and ATN-070. The ATN is supported by several of the National Institutes of Health, including NICHD, NIMH, and NIDA. So, brief background. We all know HIV infection and other STIs continue to rise among gay and bisexual male youth, and it's critical to develop sexual health promotion programs that address the realities of the sexual lives of these youth. And I'm going to be talking about attraction and dating and sexual relationships among these young men. There's a dearth of literature on attraction, dating, and romantic relationships among this population and how these factors may influence HIV and STI transmission. Purpose of this study was to explore how same-gender attraction, dating patterns, and romantic and sexual relationships of both HIV-negative and HIV-positive male adolescents and young adults are described by themselves, by the young men in the studies. So there's a limited literature on these issues. Rich Savin-Williams described a couple decades ago, looked at developmental milestones among, I think, gay and lesbian youth, and found that love relationships tended to begin around the age of 17 years old. Sexual minority adolescents who date members of their own sex have been found to be less anxious and depressed than youth who do not date at all or who are involved in opposite sex relationships. There was a recent study that came out this summer, I think it was in Journal of Adolescent Health, Bauminster et al., that found that young sexual minority men who date persons of their own sex have higher self-esteem, and young women who are dating someone of their own sex have less internalized homophobia. So there's more research that's being done. Lisa Diamond, Rich Savin-Williams, and Eric DeBay sort of differentiated between the different level, different kinds of adolescent relationships among gay and bisexual males, sexual ones, dating relationships, and romantic relationships. And passionate friendships. So, methods. There were two studies that this data was drawn from. Oh, Gary and his animation. Working this is. And his renowned purple slides. So, the first study was a study of HIV-negative youth who were recruited from two urban centers, Chicago and Miami. I apologize, the numbers of the subgroups have been transposed, so let's see. The numbers below, the 19 African Americans, 22 Latino and Hispanics, and 22 white young men actually participated. They constitute the 63 youth in the HIV negative study. And then the 31 African Americans, the 12 Latino Hispanics, and the 11 men of other race and ethnicities participated in the HIV positive study below. The HIV positive youth were recruited from the clinics where they received their HIV primary care. Both these studies were looking at various identities among these youth, how they developed during their adolescence and emerging adulthood. We're particularly interested in sexual identity development as well as ethnic and racial identity development. And then for the HIV positive study, we also structured a lot of the semi-structured interview around HIV positive identity. The data that we're discussing today came from most of the questions looking at the connection between sexual identity development and sexual risk behavior. So, all the interviews were recorded in both studies. They were transcribed and validated prior to analysis. In both studies, we used a psychological phenomenological framework, which allowed data to emerge that was just, we think it's just as important as the data that was intended to answer the primary research questions. So we had a priori codes that related to the primary research questions, looking at the sexual, the various identity development factors and health behaviors. And then what came out of a lot of this data was these young men describing their frustration with developing intimate relationships among people, the desired persons of their own sex. So we assigned codes as these new concepts emerged. Pattern codes were created to connect the sub-themes under the larger themes. Did some cross-case analysis that identified consistent patterns in meaning, concept, and themes. And then some matrices were developed. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is this tension between non-romantic and romantic relationships that these young men described. And first three sub-themes, oh, two, was an inability to relate to gay men in a non-sexual way and challenges in building non-sexual friendships with gay males. So as I present these sub-themes, there's going to be some particularly salient quotes that are illustrative of the sub-themes. I'll read them out to them because they look kind of difficult to read. I think it's more difficult to build relationships, and when I mean relationships, non-sexual or non-romantic relationships with other gay males. The only way I felt like I could relate to other gay men was sexually. It's very hard for me to be friends with other gay men. A lot of this data, those of you who went to the presentations by the Bronx Aid Services earlier this week, a lot of our data kind of aligns with what they've heard from the young men who access service there is in terms of this tension between sex and relationship building. Other sub-themes that came under this theme is a desire for one romantic partner, challenges in finding dating partners. There's a perceived small dating pool for these young men, and doubts regarding long-term gay relationships in general. This young Latino man says, it's because the selection is so few, you're probably not going to like the person that you're dating or most of them. It's kind of convenience dating as opposed to convenience sampling. Okay. When you are like dating multiple people and having sexual relationships with multiple people, then you feel kind of scandalous and you'd rather have that just one person to come home to every night. So it's a young man who's had an experience of having multiple partners, but it's really looking for that monogamous relationship. All right, so second larger theme was like a lot of these men, and this sort of speaks to the Bronx data as well, is they found it really easy to have sex, more difficult to sustain relationships. Sub-theme of viewing gay sexual encounters as easy, use of sex to combat negative emotional states, some of them talked about, participating in multiple sexual encounters as a form of self-hatred, and lack of emotional connection during sexual encounters. You just hate yourself so much because you're gay, like I would just sleep around with people for no reason, and it was really unhealthy. And it was like I did it because I just didn't feel like I deserved to be with someone doing it in a healthy manner. This young man was still HIV negative. This kid unfortunately wasn't. I felt really empty and really isolated, and then the only time that I didn't feel lonely or really isolated was when I was having sex. Okay. Other sub-themes that came under this theme was a fear of sexual contact ruining the chances of a romantic relationship developing, and the conversely is fear of losing a boyfriend if he doesn't put out. All right? So because I wanted him, I wanted to keep him as a boyfriend, so this is something you have to do, meaning having sex. But I told him, you know what, I can't do this now, I want to wait. Another one of the participants said, I mean, because like, especially with guys, I mean, like once you have sex with someone and there's no hardcore solid foundation of a relationship, I mean, there's nothing more for them to really try and explore. So it's kind of the one night stand model. Finally, a larger theme emerged around the lack of learning resources for these young men to learn about how to develop intimate relationships. So there's a lack of education in general regarding same-gender sexuality, lack of people to talk about in terms of gay dating and bouncing, you know, their experiences off of, and perceived lack of developmental milestones for the gay youth as well. This one young man said, the parents don't have a birds and bees conversation about that. That is not anything that's instructed in sex ed, where they go over the penis and the vagina, and how all that happens. They do not do the anus or anything like that. And then this kid was talking about the developmental milestones. He said, with heterosexuals, there just seem to be a lot of milestones within their lives. Just kind of like there's dating throughout high school and college, then you get engaged and married and have kids. I'm not going to have these things to tell me I'm successful now and that life's going in the right direction. Whoops. And then finally, a lot of them expressed confusion regarding their first same-gender attraction. They were thinking back retrospectively. And confusion over same-gender sexual romantic relationship status, like where they were in the present. So I was around 13 or 14 at the time when we would play around. Like some of the boys would start fighting and stuff. And when I started getting close to him, like it started feeling really just kind of odd to me. It felt like I wanted to pull him closer. I didn't understand what was going on with me at the time. And this other young man says, it's really confusing because I'm not really out with him, but like, I don't know, it's really confusing. But like, we went shopping and then we had oral sex in his car. All right, so conclusions. These data demonstrate the significant role that dating romantic relationships play in the sexual lives of gay and bisexual male youth. Future interventions should assist these young men with navigating the complex interplay of attraction, dating, and sex in order to promote their sexual health. Got a few recommendations for research and practice. So really looking at domains involving the role of culture, you know, different ethnic cultures, different geographic cultures, the role of identity, and especially among young gay men of color, the dual identity development that they have in terms of their sexual orientation and the racial and ethnic identity, and that how that may influence different behaviors. The role of attraction and meeting other gay men and dating, using mixed methods research. So, you know, using qualitative data to sort of develop larger empirical studies. Use of research focused on friendships and couples. So looking at them as like the unit or the case. And then in terms of intervention development, you know, we think it's really important to use CBPR principles and participatory action research principles involving these youth in the design and implementation of interventions so that they're relevant to like their lives as they're going on right now. Creating creative implementation strategies. Gary has started facilitating some weekend retreats of young gay men of color and sort of that are based on Rod Watt's critical consciousness theory and having these young men sort of examine the multiple sources of oppression in their lives and creating responses to those oppression that critically analyzing where the sources are coming from and creating responses that is going to improve their health and communication skills and intimate relationship building with other young gay men. And the use of technology, I think, you know, these young men are meeting a lot of other young gay men online. We've seen a lot of intervention, internet studies in this population, and also as a way that they're communicating with each other using these like emergent technologies. That's it. Thanks for your time. And I guess we're ready for questions.
Okay, thank you. Those were terrific presentations. Now we're ready for questions. I'm going to ask that for each question, the presenter that the question's for, come up to the mic because we're recording. Okay. So please.
Or kind of the barriers that you're facing in pushing for those, I guess. So I think, okay, the question so I can, so it gets recorded, is the importance of gender identity on surveys and kind of really that needs to happen. So I'm going to respond, but I don't want you to think that I disagree with you, because I strongly agree with you. I'm just going to talk about some of the challenges in survey research. Like, I should start by saying it's absolutely really important. So in survey research, for those of you who aren't doing it, every question costs money. And I fought to get transgender identity put on there. And I think more, it had nearly 50% missing. So, which I can understand, because if you're not transgender, a lot of kids don't know what it means, especially at age 13 or 14 or 15. Maybe, you know, 17 and 18 year olds do know. But anyway, because so many people did not respond to it, I didn't have a leg to stand on in putting it on the next Boston Youth Survey. And the politics with the YRBS, which Heather and Shikra used, is that's going to be hard. I mean, I think that may be 10 years, hopefully not, but there's so much politics involved in that. But just doing it on a survey research team in one city, we have to figure out a way to use the to ask the question the right way so that people will get it. And so I just wanted to, this is such a long answer, say that I loved the diversity in this panel, because there was good qualitative research and good survey research, and I think that's how research needs to go. So I'm a survey researcher, but I feel like based on this research that they talked about, I can refine questions, and then they can be good questions that people answer fully, and then people more, if you get good data, people will want to put it on surveys. So I think that's part of the problem. Thanks.
I just want to talk because I am a transgender youth, and I want to tell you about how important I think it is that we have that on a survey. It makes us feel more comfortable, and there are plenty of us out there, but if we go to places where that is not already there for us to know, we're going to be afraid to talk about it. We're already discriminated against by a heterosexual community, and then we're discriminated against also by the LGBT community, because we're something that people are afraid to talk about and to admit that it's out there, because it's such a touchy topic. It's like, we already have LGBT issues, or LGB issues. It's like, why add the T? It's more stress, more problems. But really, the only way you're going to get us out there, you're going to get to know that there's more trans people out there, is that by including us and not disincluding us, because if you disinclude us, we're not going to come out. But that's why I feel it's important that I got into this field in human services and go study in school and be a part of the youth caucus for ATH8 and have that voice for LGBT youth and also for trans people, because a lot of people do think that there's not that much trans people out there, and I'm here to tell you, I'm here right now at this talking to all of you guys, and I'm trans and I'm here and I'm youth. So that's how I feel about it.
Initial experiences of violence ones need to also be looked at. And I'm especially interested in terms of what I've read around sexual minority and gender atypical female born youth, because it, you know, from what I've read, it seems like a lot of times they experience almost twice as much psychological, physical, and sexual abuse compared to heterosexual female youth, and also experience more abuse than even gay or bisexual male youth. And oftentimes, the perpetrators are parents, and there's some studies even comparing LGBT youth with siblings and how parents will target, you know, the gender atypical youth over their heterosexual siblings. So I feel like this is a huge issue. My interest especially is around the sexual violence that's targeted towards sexual minority and gender atypical female youth.
Okay, so your point that the first violence that LGBT kids experience is in families, I think, is a really important one and one that's overlooked. I really liked Caitlin Ryan's paper in Pediatrics. She also had a great podcast on some social work podcast. But anyway, and she just talked about this issue. So I'm going to bail again and talk about how hard survey research is to understand this question. I asked a question about family support, and I actually found that kids reported, this was not consistent with what you said, but that LGBT kids reported equal levels of caregiver warmth, but not equal levels of caregiver understanding. And I think what's happening is that a lot of kids are not coming out to their parents so as to preserve the parental relationship and to avoid violence, because kids learn homophobia at such an early age. It's not like when they're five, they hear their parents saying things and they know that. So they know not to come out. So that's one thing. And I guess kids who are gender variant or really expressive, it's harder for them to not be out. And there's just something going on, and it's so under the radar sometimes. Sometimes it's absolutely not, especially what Paula talked about, which was horrifying. But I mean, that's one reason I wanted to say that I think we need to study other kinds of violence, and we absolutely need to study the family dynamic. I feel like LGBT youth research has just been peers. And now, I don't know, it's just the sexy topic in the media, and everybody's talking about bullying in the schools, and there's more out there. There's violence within gay relationships. There's, you know, violence within families. So it's not just bullying. That's like a piece of the pie.
Yeah, and I just want to add, especially for, I think, LGBT youth of color, you know,
yeah,
it can be very complicated because there's evidence that they experience even more violence than Euro-American white LGBT youth, and that and more violence in their families at the same time that they may also be getting resiliency from their families around, you know, race and other types. So it I think can be very complicated.
Absolutely. And in Boston, we have a lot of Caribbean immigrants, either first generation or second generation, and that's a very homophobic culture. And so I do fear for them, but my sense is that they're not coming out to preserve that relationship and just, I don't know, waiting to go to college or something. But it's really important. Again, I just have to say this panel was awesome, and I loved that people were talking about lots of different cultures of LGBT youth, not just, you know, bullying in white suburbia.
I think with both of the last questions, what's striking to me is that I think oftentimes we're studying bodies and what bodies do and the behavior and risk that's associated with bodies. So we forget that identity can be separate from that, and then we try to study behaviors. And so there's all this missing information because we're not putting it together. Physical bodies have physical results from risk, but if we're trying to figure out why people are doing things and how they're thinking and why they're behaving the way they are, we should consider the whole person, which identity is something that's completely different. So I don't think that it can't be included. I just think we need to make it a priority and figure out how to ask the question correctly.
Well, I
I'm from Boulder County. We do the YRBS data, so it's actually for you. We ask how people identify, but we don't actually ask who they're having sex with. And is there a huge difference in like more kids? Is there a lot more kids who are able to identify? Because I'd like to be able to get us to do that and we can support that. So there was a certain percentage that were identifying and it's a long day. And then a certain percentage that that were having sex. Was there a big difference?
You mean have the concordance of those two questions? There's lots of discordance.
Okay.
I mean, you can't assume that just because someone identifies as lesbian that they're going to only report.
Absolutely. I was just wondering if you actually saw that it was like what the, maybe you could speak to it on yours. I don't know.
Well, we only studied one and that was a limitation.
Yeah.
I think if you have the power to get the behavior question on there, get it on there. It is so much better.
I just researched it, backed it up with the county.
Well, we could give you that research.
Yeah. The problem with just having only a behavior question, though, is that you're excluding a whole bunch of
people. No, we want both. We have them well identified, but we don't have the behavior question. And I know that there's a variant. I'm just curious if you could say there's such a large group of missing that they would want to put it.
Absolutely, and I think that relates to the last presentation because some, probably boys more so than girls, are having sex but not talking about it. So I think you should definitely get it on there. And both Heather and I are in touch with the people who do YRBS in Massachusetts and can run the data and you know maybe give you some hard stuff about how much more people you'll catch.
I think what I want to say about that is to think about what you want to investigate and then what questions should you ask based on that. I mean, if you want to investigate sexual health, and that's part of the aims of your YRBS, then having a question on sexual behavior is very useful. I mean, those questions do correlate differently with different health outcomes. For example, we know that if you ask an attraction question or a sex question, the associations with violence is attenuated than an association between an identity question and violence. If you have an identification, you're identifying as gay, lesbian, or bisexual, you see greater disparities in violence comparing heterosexual identified youth, the LGB identified youth, than if you have just an attraction question. So they capture different populations, they capture different experiences, and if you want to capture those experiences a little more fully, then another question is useful.
Yeah, two more questions. So I saw your hand first, and then
okay. First of all, I just really want to thank the panel. I too found this really exciting. And as someone who works with LGBTQ youth in the community, these discussions have been long overdue. One of the things that I think I want to underscore is that in this country, we don't have quality sexuality education for children, period. So that means for our sexual minority youth that we are totally left out in the cold. And I think if we're talking about social justice and public health issues, that this is what we're seeing, particularly the issues around violence are becoming incredibly disturbing. And so I appreciate it. I forget who said it earlier that yes, bullying and the suicide issues are critical, but I think if we're really going to address the public health issues, we've got to look at the underlying problems. And I do think we need to look at familial relationships and what's going on there and how parents are reacting to their youth and supporting or not supporting their youth. So anyway, thank you for your work.
Last question.
This could be to several of the folks on the panel, you can decide. I'm Gary Hollander in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I just want to know, if you felt the struggle in reporting risk behavior, that somehow our whole conceptualization of risk behavior is that it exists and it has something to do with that person as opposed to the context in which they're living. And I'm just wondering if you're like thinking about, talking about in terms of vulnerability to, as a contrast to risk. And then that was that one part of the question. That just, there's something about vulnerability to societal oppression and then not talking about it in terms of homophobia, but call it oppression. Have you struggled with that in reporting, or challenged yourself with it?
So I'm a public health person and I talk about risk all the time, and I think you make a really good point, and I do forget that sometimes, but I had a student who was working with me and he was just doing some lit reviews and he was just like, this is so depressing. It's like suicide and this and that. And I, you know, we do have to push back on that a little bit and just really recognize that this is a completely preventable environmental issue. And I loved your Paula's stress-induced psychiatric disorders or something. That was a great way to word it. I mean, you just can't, you're right. We can't underscore that enough. We need to do more of that.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming and safe travels back. Thanks.